Today is Monday, April 27th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, as some U.S. states prepare to reopen, New York's governor says while cases are declining, there are still too many.
Death is death. 367 people passed, 367 families.
As the world fights COVID-19, experts warn of a looming global hunger pandemic. Also ahead, the life of the late Whitney Houston will be made into a film. It's all on today's International Edition. More U.S. states are preparing to lift coronavirus restrictions against the warnings of many public health experts who say increased human interaction could spark a new wave of cases that has already killed more than 54,000 Americans. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo on Sunday talked about a phased approach to reopening while reporting the state's lowest daily total since March 30th. He said there's still a ways to go.
The overall hospitalization rate is down. The number of intubations is down. Even the number of new COVID cases is down, still not good. Still 1,000 new COVID cases yesterday, to put it in focus. That would normally be terrible news. It's only not terrible news compared to where we were. This is just terrible news. 367 deaths, which is horrific, and there is no relative context to death. Death is death. 367 people passed, 367 families.
Cuomo said construction and manufacturing would be the first businesses to reopen and could restart after May 15th in the upstate region with certain precautions and if cases continue to decline. New York and other states have extended their stay-at-home restrictions to mid-May amid a backdrop of scattered protests across the country calling for stay-at-home orders to be lifted. Other states, mainly those with Republican governors, have already taken steps to restart their economies after a month of government-ordered lockdowns. After 7 weeks in lockdown to contain one of the world's worst outbreaks of COVID-19, Italians are regaining some of their freedoms. Premier Giuseppe Conte announcing that starting May 4th, public parks and gardens will reopen and people will be able to visit relatives who live in the same region. However, Conte told the nation in a televised address Sunday night that citizens must practice social distancing. The number of COVID-19 patients in intensive care in France is continuing to trend downward. The overall death toll from France's outbreak is now up to more than 22,800, just behind only Italy and Spain in Europe. More than a third of France's victims died in care facilities, mostly for the elderly. In the UK, Boris Johnson is back after recovering from a coronavirus infection that put him in intensive care. The British Prime Minister is set to return to work amid growing criticism of his government's efforts over the handling of the outbreak. AP correspondent Karen Chamas reports.
Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab, who has been standing in for the Prime Minister, said that Johnson has made a full recovery 2 weeks after his release from hospital.
As you can imagine, with the Prime Minister, he's raring to go.
Britain has recorded more than 20,000 deaths among people hospitalised with COVID-19, the fifth country in the world to reach that total. Thousands more are thought to have died in nursing homes. Opposition politicians say Britain's coronavirus death toll could have been lower if Johnson had imposed a nationwide lockdown sooner, and also criticised his government over shortages of protective equipment for medical workers and a lack of testing for the virus. With hundreds of new deaths announced each day, some health experts say Britain could eventually have the highest virus death toll in Europe. Karen Chamas, London.
The Netherlands is sending urgent medical supplies to Greece to help shield tens of thousands of migrants and refugees following a series of COVID-19 outbreaks in Greek refugee camps. The government in Athens is boosting controls there, but it's also tightening lockdown rules for migrants, stripping violators of asylum rights, and slapping them with heavy fines. Anthony Karasava has the story from Athens.
Throughout the COVID crisis, Greece has been a model paradigm, flattening its curve of infections with aggressive measures and lockdowns enforced from the start. Now, though, days before the government in Athens moves to ease some of these controls, Concerns mount over a sudden spike in cases in some of the scores of refugee camps scattered across the country. In the southern Peloponnese region alone, about 150 migrants have tested positive at a hotel and rundown resort that has been converted into a shelter to house about 500 migrants, mainly from Cameroon and the Democratic Republic of Congo. An aid worker and a member of the hotel staff have also been found infected. None, though, have shown serious symptoms so far. Still, the outbreak at the hotel camp follows two others recorded in different migrant establishments this week. This after migrants claimed they were being neglected and left uninformed throughout this health crisis, sparking protests with demonstrators setting fire to a refugee camp on the island of Chios after a young Iraqi asylum seeker died from what appeared to be the coronavirus. With tensions brewing at the camps, many migrants have been caught sneaking out of the squalid and overcrowded establishments, trying to find refuge elsewhere, a move that poses a huge health risk and may compromise Greece's success in controlling the pandemic. With the country hosting more than 100,000 refugees in 93 camps across the country, though, the government is scrambling to contain the camp infections, fearing the camps may turn into dangerous flashpoints. Migration and Asylum Minister Notis Mitsotakis says he'll think twice about easing lockdown controls at these facilities before the end of next month. Until then, though, he says migrants caught violating quarantines will be barred from applying for asylum. They will also face stiff fines and be deported back to their homelands or neighboring Turkey. Human rights advocates have already cast a critical eye at that decision, and it remains unclear how authorities will press ahead with forced returns as countries like Turkey have closed their borders to contain the spread of the coronavirus. Facing the prospect of coping for years with a migrant crisis that is far from abating, Mitsotakis says Greece wants the EU to step in and organize the deportations. He says Greece alone can no longer shoulder the burden of Europe's lingering refugee crisis. Antikarasava for VOA News, Athens, Greece.
Ghana lifted a three-week partial lockdown in its capital, Accra, last week, allowing businesses to reopen, including hair salons and barbershops. Critics who say it's too soon to relax the restrictions point out social distancing is impossible when someone is cutting your hair. Some Ghanaians, though, who during the lockdown lamented the scruffy state of their hair in social media posts and even tried to get home services despite the risks, are now rushing to salons to regain their style. Stacey Knott reports from Accra.
In Ghana, salons and barbershops are social pillars and play a big part in the economy, according to Kor Aisa, owner of natural hair salon Twists and Locks Salon. Across Ghana, services can come from street-side barbers in converted shipping containers to lavish, well-equipped salons. Aisa says the hair business provides a way for many to support themselves, especially those without much formal education. She closed both her salon locations before the lockdown announcement to protect her staff and clients, but when the lockdown ended, she was inundated with inquiries about the reopening. Aisa is following government calls to enforce strong hygiene and social distancing measures. Her spacious salons can keep clients well separated, and she has put measures in place, including frequent cleaning of surfaces and requiring face masks. While the stylists are not able to maintain distance from their clients, she is confident her salons are doing their part to keep people safe. But clients must comply with their measures, and her stylists can turn uncooperative customers away.
If someone refuses to adhere to the protocols, if someone is coughing and comes in and is not going to wear a face mask, they would respectfully, politely indicate to the client that we will not be able to serve them. And at that point, it really has to be understood by the client. If it isn't, it's not something that we're willing to compromise on, because this is an issue of life and death.
People have also been trooping into Kingsmen Barbers since it reopened after the lockdown lifted. Owner Salom Kluche says the three-week closure was hard on the business, his staff and clients. He had people contacting him during the lockdown looking for home services.
They call on the phone to ask, so are we working, are we going to offer home service? And the thing is, we couldn't have offered home service because the lockdown was enforced by the law enforcement agency. So it made moving around, it wasn't possible. We just had to obey the law.
Since reopening Monday, he has also tried to institute a range of health and safety measures, including spacing clients and high hygiene standards for customers and barbers. Public health expert Nana Kofikwache from the New York University School of Global Public Health has been back home in Ghana during the lockdown period. Kwache was surprised when Ghana lifted the lockdown because of his concerns about testing and tracing. He also questioned whether there was enough analysis of the impact of the lockdown before it was lifted. He said that although desire for haircuts was understandable, there was still a risk of local transmission, especially given the impossibility of maintaining social distancing. However, with the government indicating a lower risk now, it was unfair to blame businesses for wanting to reopen, he said. Lifting the lockdown was in part aimed at allowing the economy to start moving, especially because many had suffered significant losses under it, he said.
People in the informal sector, those entrepreneurs working in barbershops and salons who survive on their daily wages, who survive on their daily hustle, could resume some economic activity so they could literally put food on the table, feed themselves and feed their families. So if you take for granted the government's view on the question of there being a lowered risk, then it's difficult to make a case for why they shouldn't be allowed to be opened if other sectors of the economy are actually open.
Kwache, who used to frequent a barber before the pandemic, says he is now, like many around the world, looking up YouTube videos for some do-it-yourself inspiration. Stacey Knott for VOA News, Accra, Ghana.
Thousands of Cameroonian prisoners have effectively regained their freedom as ordered by the Central African State's president, Paul Biya, after his government reported that the coronavirus pandemic was spreading and inmates were among the groups with the highest level of exposure. The government has, however, not provided the number of infected inmates, but says more than 1,500 people have tested positive for COVID-19 in Cameroon in less than 2 months, with only 50 deaths. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Speaking via a messaging application from Cameroon's English-speaking northwestern town of Bamenda, Henry Asangu, superintendent of the Bamenda Central Prison, says the 138 inmates who have regained their freedom were all tested COVID-19 free. He says their departure makes it possible for prison staff to ensure that compliance with principles of hygiene is effective to check the spread of the coronavirus.
With this release, we will be able to apply very strictly that aspect of social distancing even within the prison.
The Bamenda Central Prison has 403 officially declared inmates. Cameroon has 78 overcrowded prisons with 30,000 prisoners in detention facilities constructed for a maximum of 9,000 inmates. Among the 1,400 who have regained their freedom from the Bamenda, Bavusam, Betua, and Boya Central prisons is Emmanuel Ngumba. He says he was arrested 2 years ago at 16 and held at the Boya Central prison.
I left the house one evening to go and see a friend. He said he wanted us to go and take some things from his uncle's shop. When they took some gas bottles and engine oil, so they caught me. Prison is not a good place.
Ngumba, who spoke via a messaging application, said his rights were abused because he was accused of theft and detained in prison for 2 years without trial. 52-year-old Pierre Chamba also regained his freedom after more than 24 years in the Betwa prison, where he was given a life sentence for voluntary manslaughter and aggravated theft.
If I've been cut more, the prison, la prison n'est pas une bonne
Chamba says after 24 years and 4 months of detention in inhumane conditions, he has finally regained his freedom thanks to COVID-19, which has been spreading in Cameroon and infecting inmates. A crisis meeting chaired by Cameroonian Prime Minister Joseph John Nguté last week announced that COVID-19 was a threat in Cameroon prisons, but did not say how many inmates had been contaminated or have died from the pandemic. On April 15, President Biya ordered the release of thousands of prisoners over concerns about congested facilities spreading the coronavirus. Under the presidential decision, life sentences were reduced to 25 years, and those for whom life sentences had been reduced to 25 years had 5 years taken off their sentences. 10-year sentences were cut by 3 years, 5-year sentences reduced by 2 years, and 3-year sentences cut by 1 year. However, separatists fighting for an independent English-speaking state in the Central African nation and officials jailed for corruption were excluded. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
The United Nations food chief is warning that while the world fights the coronavirus pandemic, it's also on the brink of a hunger pandemic. The executive director of the World Food Program met with U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to discuss ways to avert the worst humanitarian crisis since World War II. VOA diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain has more.
Armed conflict and poverty are already forcing millions of people around the world to go to bed hungry every night.
The World Food Program analysis shows also, due to the coronavirus, that an additional 130 million people could be pushed to the brink of starvation by the end of 2020. That's a total of 265 million people.
Humanitarian organizations, such as the Christian group World Relief, are also sounding the alarm. World Relief says the focus is likely to shift from coronavirus health-related concerns to starvation.
When we think just a few steps ahead, the potential impact on economics and food security could be devastating for much of the world, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, East Africa, Southern Africa particularly. Where the economic factors are going to be significant contributing to food insecurity, especially in areas that we don't usually see it in, like urban areas.
World Relief is calling on the U.S. and other countries to take decisive action.
So we, along with other international development agencies, are calling for the U.S. government to appropriate another $12 billion towards international assistance for this crisis.
If the world fails to act, relief experts say more than 30 countries could face famine as remittances from overseas and tourism revenues dry up. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
The COVID-19 pandemic has had some serious political and economic implications when it comes to U.S.-China relations. I talked about some of those implications with David Feierstein, president and CEO of the George H.W. Bush Foundation for U.S.-China Relations. The nonprofit Houston, Texas-based organization is working to improve political and trade relations between the two countries. In part one of this two-part interview, I asked Feierstein to describe some of those implications.
I think there is a qualitative difference between this pandemic in terms of its impact on U.S.-China relations and really any other episode or event that has occurred in the relationship, at least from a U.S. perspective. And the big difference is that whereas, you know, China has often done things that the United States doesn't like or that is seen as problematic from the standpoint of U.S. interests, and also the reverse is true, the U.S. often does things that Chinese see as problematic or antithetical to their interests. In this particular instance, there is a narrative in this country that has really taken hold, certainly in Washington, and I think seemingly increasingly across the country, judging by public opinion polls, that China has done something bad with respect to its handling of COVID-19 and the early epidemic, now pandemic, and that what China has done has hurt America in ways that we've never seen before, and even taken American life to the tune of potentially thousands, or obviously tens of thousands now, however one might allocate the varying elements of responsibility. The fact is, you know, tens of thousands of Americans so far have died from this virus. And I think there are people in this country that believe that, again, in their view, China somehow unleashed this on us in a sinister way. So I think the mindset, largely on the Republican side, but also we see some of these comments from both Republicans and Democrats, you know, there's this sense that China has really done something it's never done before, and that it has struck a blow not only to the U.S. economy, because that allegation and that assertion has been out there for decades, but now to American life itself. That makes this different than previous shocks to the system when it comes to U.S.-China relations.
Whether or not China did something intentionally or not, what economic ramifications will the perceptions have in the future for the U.S. and China?
I think the most immediate or maybe profound impact, I think, is going to be on how the United States thinks about supply chains. And obviously, the degree of integration between the United States and China that has developed over the last several decades, and which has still been very substantial even during the 3 years plus of the Trump administration, I think that is now seen by more Americans as problematic and risky, an undue level of dependence on the part of the United States toward China and its economy. And I think that there is an emerging view in this country, and it was a view that I think was not as widely held up until COVID-19, but it's a view that the United States needs to scale back its presence in China. It needs to depend less on China economically, in terms of supply chain, in terms of perhaps even being a source of consumption of U.S. goods and services. That is one of the most profound emerging impacts, I think, from the COVID-19 situation. A lot of people are saying, look, we need to start not just, quote, producing here, making America great again by making things in America again, but to go further and say we need to really have our own supply chain capacity, our own ability to supply our industrial production processes, pharmaceuticals, and so on, either domestically or from countries other than China. So I think that in this particular regard, for those who kind of ideologically over these past 3 years or so have said, you know, we need to have sort of an America first mindset and, you know, reduce our dependency on China, I think the COVID-19 gives them some ammunition to take to the American public and try to sell that argument with a greater sense of urgency than they were able to do before.
In your view, is it a good thing to pull away and go in that direction?
No, I don't think it is. It's not a good thing for the United States. And that's the main prism through which I look at these issues. I think it's a bad idea, not because it's bad for China, but because it's bad for us in a variety of different ways. I'm, I guess, old-fashioned, like I think some in the United States still are. I believe in the construct of comparative advantage. I believe trade is a good thing, and that more trade is a better thing, that integrating economies is good economically and makes sense by virtue of economic theory, but also tends to reduce the likelihood of armed conflict. And for all the reasons that I think have traditionally been embraced by presidents of both parties, congresses of both parties, and so on, I still believe that the largest and second largest economies in the world ought to work together, ought to leverage their complementarities, ought to leverage their respective comparative advantages, ought to trade, ought to be open to all lawful and job-creating investment. And I still think those things are good things for this country. And I think that the reason the United States became the economic powerhouse that it has become and did become over the last several decades is because we did all of those things. I think turning our back on those ideas that contributed mightily to America's rise as an economic player and as a superpower is a very unwise thing to do and a very short-sighted thing to do.
David Feierstein, President and CEO of the George H.W. Bush Foundation for U.S.-China Relations. Coming up shortly in part two of our interview, we will hear about the foundation's newly established U.S.-China Coronavirus Action Network. Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. Israel's Supreme Court ruled Sunday that the government must bring legislation to its use of mobile phone tracking deployed in the battle against the new coronavirus. Circumventing Parliament in March, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's cabinet approved emergency regulations that enabled the Internal Security Service to tap into cellular data to retrace the movements of people infected by the virus. But the court ruling cited grave dangers to privacy. India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi on Sunday urged his citizens to comply with a nationwide lockdown and social distancing measures. In a radio address, Modi said the country was in the midst of a war and the country's 1.3 billion citizens should not be misled into believing the spread of the virus has been brought fully under control by more than a month of lockdowns. And Chile will push ahead with previously announced release certificates for recovered COVID-19 patients, despite a World Health Organization warning that there was no evidence that they are protected from a second coronavirus infection. Chile's health ministry Sunday said many uncertainties remain. Stay with VOA for all the latest U.S. and world news. And now for part two of our interview with David Firestein, president and CEO of the George H.W. Bush Foundation for U.S.-China Relations. Would you say it's basically we've given power to China?
In some ways, I think that is one way to put it. Another way that I would put it is that in some ways, I think we're adopting Chinese worst practices as best practices to be emulated. And I think that we are steadily going down the road during the course of this administration of, in a sense, trying to adopt policies that we have long criticized China for adopting, whether that's industrial policy, whether that's subsidies, whether that's being less receptive to foreign investment. The list goes on and on. You know, in a sense, we're losing because we are starting to do things the way that we've always been very critical of when others have done them that way. And I think we're losing our way as a country. One case in point is the issue of agriculture. This administration has said to America's farmers and ranchers, we're going to make it through the implementation of tariffs and then the countervailing tariffs that China put in place. We, the administration, are going to make it very difficult for you to sell your agricultural products to China. But in lieu of that, we will pay you a large government subsidy with money we don't have to try to make it right. So we're paying farmers an income they don't need with money we don't have. You know, if that's not a good working definition of old school socialism, I don't know what is. And I don't think that's the path we took to become the economic superpower that we became. And I think if we start to get away from the principles of the market, from the principles of comparative advantage, from the principles of increasing levels of openness to trade and investment, I think that's going to hurt our nation. And if you look at the tariff policy implemented by the Trump administration, one thing's very clear. They haven't worked. The United States has a larger merchandise deficit with China than we've ever had. In fact, we hit the record in 2018, and the average U.S. goods deficit with China in the Trump administration well exceeds the average goods deficit with China under the administration of any president in the history of the United States. We've had the largest two U.S. total goods deficits with the world under the Trump administration. We've lost manufacturing jobs, not gain them. And American consumers are paying up to $1,500 more for the same basket of goods that they were paying $1,500 less for 2 years ago. And all of this, by the way, is still happening at a time when the United States has lost 22 million jobs in the last 5 weeks. I think what the Trump administration has successfully done is found a solution to the problem that was worse than the problem.
Let's talk about your organization's efforts regarding cooperation between the U.S. and China. I understand that the foundation is established the U.S.-China Coronavirus Action Network. What exactly is that and what is the goal here?
The U.S.-China Coronavirus Action Network, or U.S.-China CAN, C-A-N, is an effort on the part of the George H.W. Bush Foundation for U.S.-China Relations to link questions with answers and to connect needs with resources and capacity and to bring together people who haven't been brought together but who could fruitfully come together and perhaps work together to mitigate the negative impact, both from a health standpoint and an economic standpoint, of COVID-19.
David Firestein, president and CEO of the George H.W. Bush Foundation for U.S.-China Relations. And Whitney Houston is headed back to the big screen in a feature film about the singer's life that took her to the heights of fame but ended in drug addiction and tragedy. Taking its title from one of Houston's biggest hits, I Want to Dance with Somebody, the film has the backing of the singer's estate and her longtime record producer and mentor, Clive Davis. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Please take care and be well.